along with several others who didn't feel at all good about it, and 5 negative votes. And from then on, practically every faculty meeting, 5 negative votes. And we were pretty well isolated. And even when we had some things that we thought were very positive and helpful to the faculty, I guess we just weren't being heard anymore, which is understandable. At any rate, along came New Orleans. The report came out, the faculty rejection, faculty majority rejection of the report, and along came New Orleans, and then the history you fairly well know. 309, the infamous or famous resolution that condemned the theology that was coming out of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. A shocking decision. One that nobody on the campus of St. Louis Seminary ever dreamt would take place. That this great institution where Walther, Pieper had been present, and the older Fairbrenner and all those, could be condemned by the majority of a synod meeting. It was unthinkable. They were condemned, perhaps you know what they were condemned for, the various things. One was the authority of Scripture. One was, it's all here. I don't know if I want to read it all. It's an enormous thing. It took 45 minutes for the vice president of the Minnesota district to read the thing. Of course, he did read rather slowly, which made it all the more painful because everybody could read ahead of him, you know. No, it was a shocking thing. But it was gospel reductionism, third use of the law, authority of Scripture, this type of thing. These are the issues, of course, that have confronted us all this time. I remember my good friend Norman Hobble. I don't think Kurt has quite an Australian accent. He's eclectic, but Norman has this Australian accent, which I cannot really imitate, except that he always called me Bob. My friends call me Robert, some of them call me Bob, but Bob, you know, it's an Australian accent. And he was Bob, how could this thing happen? Why, he says, we are a conservative seminary. Look at Harvard. Look at Princeton. Look at Chicago, Union. And I felt kind of sorry for him. Norman, of course, being from Australia, he had never had the privilege of growing up in Highland Park, Illinois, under Reverend Sewer, the way I had, and gotten confirmed and learned at the age of 13 that the papacy was the Antichrist, all these other things. Really, I don't think he ever realized, as an Australian, the mentality of the average Missouri Synod Lutheran, especially the laity, 40% of whom have gone through our parochial schools. And I simply told him, Norman, I'm sorry that you don't understand, but I said, what you don't realize is that the people here, the laymen particularly, but also the clergy, think that whether Adam and Eve were real people is a tremendously important thing. You don't. You're perfectly happy that it's an open question. But they do. And for years I tried to persuade you and the rest of the faculty that this was coming, because you had grown out of touch with your church body. And now this is the result of it. And complete shock. I might say on that particular point, the historicity of Adam and Eve is immensely important. The whole doctrine of original sin, according to Western Christendom, involves, among other things, if you'll read Pieper's Dogmatics and maybe St. Augustine and a few other things, that the sin of the one man was imputed to the whole human race, just as the righteousness of the one man, Romans 5, is imputed to the whole human race. If you can't believe in a real, Adam and Eve, you can't believe in a real imputation by God, and then the human race is not counted guilty by God. And the whole thing breaks down, you see. So reality, history underlying these great doctrines of original sin, atonement and so forth, is fundamental to the Christian faith. Well, be that as it may, I argued that with my colleagues down there enough. At any rate, the 309 went through. What, 60-40, something like that? Rather decisively, and it caused tremendous heartache and consternation. Home came the faculty, majority. The minority five were no longer even invited to faculty meetings. That's the truth. Home they came to St. Louis. Now they had, I think, certain choices or options open. One might have been to say, look, right or wrong, a solid majority of our church has rejected us. Maybe they misunderstood us. Maybe they're wrong and we're right. But certainly we can't ignore the fact that this is the case. Let us now finally quit resisting this attempt to find out what we teach and sit down and counsel with people and say, yes, teach us if we're wrong. But no, without counseling with anybody, they wrote a total rejection of what the synod had done in terms of 309. What has happened here, you see? First, they are alienated from the president of the synod because they won't accept his jurisdiction or his investigation. Then they are alienated from the Board of Higher Education. They are gradually alienated from the Board of Control. Now they need these boards. These boards are the boards that keep us going as an institution of higher learning. And finally, the very synod itself they are willing to take on in this precipitous way. And then the die's cast. I mean, you can't draw back. There's no place for discussion, no negotiation, nothing. I'm not asking for union negotiations or compromise, but just plain negotiation. There is no way to discuss after this. A total rejection of what the Synod did. The Synod sinned. The Synod did wrong. And the only one thing, the Synod must reverse itself. And we will continue as we have done. And we will not accept the judgment of the Synod or of the investigating committee or of anyone else. Well, nothing was done. It was just sort of presented, this rejection. Fall started, 73. Everybody very tense, students particularly. There had been another resolution, 312A here, which had said that the Board of Control is to deal with Dr. Deachin as the one responsible for anything wrong at the seminary. And there was a new Board of Control after New Orleans, which rather than 7-4 in favor of teaching was now 6-5, you might say, critical of him. And it was just a matter of time until Dr. Teachin would be dealt with in a very strong way, because Dr. Teachin was not going to give in. And it kind of looked as if the board wasn't. And that's the way it turned out. So in January, I believe it was, 74, the whole thing broke open. Dr. Teachin was suspended for 12 different reasons. We need not go into all of them. Some of them have dealt with his unwillingness to do what the board told him to do. But others were for harboring or defending false doctrine and not really carrying out his duties as the overseer of the seminary in that respect. The day after he was suspended, the students went on what they call a moratorium. The moratorium was embarked upon for this reason alone. They, according to 309, did not, they knew, according to that resolution, passed at New Orleans, that false doctrine was being taught at the seminary, but they did not know who was teaching it, because the resolution didn't say that. Therefore, they said they would not go back to class until the Board of Control told them which professors were teaching true doctrine and which were teaching false doctrine. Now, there's something a little naive. First of all, there's something a little phony about this action of the students, if I might say so. And secondly, there's something naive about it. The phony thing about it is that if they really felt this way, they shouldn't have waited until Dr. Teachin was suspended. They should have done it in the fall quarter, simply not come back. Because if it's only 309 they're objecting to, that had already taken place the summer before. Okay? There's no way they can get around it. They were naive in thinking that the board, if they really thought it, and I think a lot of them did, they were naive in thinking that the board could possibly, in any short period of time, cope with ferreting out who taught what, and then dealing with them and seeing whether they understood them correctly, whether the man would change his position, whether he'd been misunderstood, whatever it is. You see what I mean? These things take great time. And a board is not a constant thing like a staff. A board meets every month. And they're businessmen and pastors, and you're lucky if you can get a day's work a month out of them. So it was just impossible for the board to cope with this request of the students in an effective way. The board answered immediately. And they said, we will try to do what you ask with all deliberate haste, which is the best they could do. Now, the next day, before the board ever had a chance to answer, the next day, the faculty walked off the job. So it was really all pretty well planned in advance. The faculty, however, gave completely different demands than the students before they would come back. And their demand centered primarily in the reinstatement of Dr. Arliss Allen, who had been simply not rehired by the Board for Higher Education, which really had nothing to do with the synodical action at all, but was merely a BAG action of a long time before, and was an impossible thing to do anything about. I mean, it's like trying to bring a man back to life or something, or Peter Damian back in the Middle Ages, medieval Franciscan scholastic, thought that God was so powerful he could make the past so that it hadn't happened. Now basically, the Seminex faculty are followers of Peter Damian. They are trying simply to turn back the clock and make the past so that it didn't happen, and you can't do that. Well, I don't know if I made my point there, but anyway. The second reason was that they would not go back to work until Dr. Teachin was reinstated. And this was the real challenge, I guess, and this was the hardest time down at St. Louis. Probably the hardest time that a lot of us have ever had. When the board suspended Dr. Teachin, they had to put in an interim president. I think they asked Ralph Bowman, but he didn't want it. Can't say I blame him. That would have been a terrible job. So they asked Dr. Charlevoix. Dr. Charlevoix, he maybe hasn't always been known for his tact, but one thing I'll tell you, he's a soldier. And when he's asked to volunteer for duty, he doesn't shirk it. And he said, I go, sir. Well, some of the Seminex people have said later, if it had been Bowman or Preuss, we might have stayed, but not Charlevoix. I'm not so sure. I think they had their plans pretty well made. At any rate, Charlevoix was president, and three-fourths of the students would jeer him publicly if he spoke, and none of the faculty. While they refused to teach, they took over the entire operation. They had the chapel. They kept on spending money. They kept on getting their salary. They kept on doing everything except what they were called to do, teach students. And they had meetings at least twice a day, every day, with students. Dr. Charlevoix tried to set the meeting. We tried to keep classes going. I had some classes. I kept teaching them. In my second year class, most of the students quit. In my first year class, since they hadn't been quite so, won over, they pretty well kept going. And those fellows stayed there all along the line. So I kept teaching. Bowman was on leave. Wunderlich was on leave. Klann was on leave. And Charlevoix and I were the only two men there that continued to teach. And we kept that seminary going, that quarter. We got guys in so fast you wouldn't believe it. In the third quarter, we had something like 16 men teaching there. Four men from this place, some of you may recall. Walray, Wensey, Scare, and Hinsey. And then we got all kinds of adjunct people from there. I don't think those Seminex guys ever thought for a minute that place would stay open. But by the grace of God, it did. Their idea, of course, was to break the back of the Board of Control. Board of Control, according to the Constitution, cannot close the school. They must keep the school open. And I'm sure the faculty felt the only way they could do it was to bring teaching back and the faculty back and say, let's negotiate a little bit more. Well, it didn't happen that way. The board remained quite adamant. For 30 days, they had total control of that institution, but they did let us teach our courses. They didn't harass me in class. Since Dr. Charlemagne was such a persona non grata for various reasons, which I don't think he deserved, I called meetings constantly of students, trying to say, look, may we hear you out? Any concerns you might have, we'll listen to it. And I guarantee you, I happen to know the President of the Synod quite well, and I will bring any concern to him. You know, I know Ed Weber, I know the Board of Control, I know all these people, and I promise you that whatever concern you have, whatever point you want to make, I will bring it to these people, and in the meantime, I'll try to present their case to you. A lot of students came, although maybe 100 came to these meetings that I set up, which wasn't many because they maybe had 500 on campus. And of the 100, probably 80% of them were those that finally stayed. So very few of the other students ever came. And I feel we just never, well, from a long time before that, there was just no rapport. There was no meeting, no way that we could discuss issues in a dispassionate, objective way anymore. It had gone too far. At any rate, we tried. And for those 30 days, we had a pretty tough time. In the meantime, Dr. Charlemagne had a breakdown. I guess the people that have nervous breakdowns or nervous exhaustion are often the people that are very tense and committed to things. If you're an easygoing nothing, you aren't going to have a nervous breakdown, I don't think. I'm no psychologist. Well, he had this breakdown, so that left me. Nobody wanted me, least of all my brother. But I was the only one left. Wunderlich was 65. Richard Klann, if possible, was even more unpopular than I was. I shouldn't say that on tape. Charlemagne was out of the picture. Bowman was elsewhere working for the CTCR. So I had to take over. And so I was president, academic dean, vice president, taught third of the courses, dean of chapel, you name it. Well, we got a lot of help from various people, and we survived. After a month of this utter chaos, I might just say this. There were some things that happened there that I don't think anybody should be too proud of. Every night of my life, the phone rang at all hours, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, I'm real sensible when things like that come. I just take the phone off the hook, go back to bed. Charlemagne, I guess what? My phone, I always met silence. His phone, I think he met, one day it would be Tannhäuser, next Lohengrin, quadruple forte over the phone. And I guess he just felt he had to answer the phone in case someone from the BHE or someone else might have been calling him, or people, members of the family, and it just got to him. And so nervous exhaustion. Well, the fourth, after 1 month, exactly 30 days, the Board of Control met. They gave the faculty 48 hours either to come back and continue what they were called to do, teach, or they would be simply legally, according to the state of Missouri, dismissed for breach of contract. And after 48 hours, nothing happened, and that, so it just went that way. Meanwhile, we prepared for the third quarter, and as some of you remember, we carried out the third quarter with 106 students, and things went pretty well. In fact, really quite quietly, because after those 30 days, they immediately formed Seminex. Finished out the quarter, at St. Louis U, started the next quarter, and they were pretty well gone, although they still used our library, our dining hall, and all the other facilities. But they weren't in the classrooms, and they didn't take over the chapel and the whole institution the way they had done during those 30 days. I haven't even looked at my notes. I don't know why I even bother. I'm so well organized here. Yeah. Well, Seminex continued, and I guess everybody realized it would. That spring was a difficult time. Some of you seniors remember that, I guess. In March, we were up in Chicago and trying to place Vickers. That would have been you people, wouldn't it? You seniors. And Seminex sent their men up there and one of them placed. Dr. Wunderlich and Professor Phil Schrader, who died shortly thereafter, were sent up as our men. And after one night, staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning, and harassed, they both came home exhausted. So I had to go up. That's another position I had, field work director. So I went up, and all the district presidents were there, and the Springfield men were there. I forget, no doubt, Costello, I remember, and Schlecht, and some of those. And the upshot of it was that the Seminex men would get vicarages, but under the supervision of the Board for Higher Education. So that was settled. And Professor Lessman, who was the head of the whole operation in St. Louis, didn't like it one little bit, but he finally acquiesced after calling up John Teachin and getting permission to do so. He really didn't have any choice. Later that spring, it became more difficult, however, because the placement procedure set in. There are so many calls. And you had this seminary with something like 76 or something men. You had 801 with maybe 26 or 28 or 30 or whatever we had, I forget. And then Seminex with maybe 90. And they wanted to get into the slotting process. You see, if you know how this goes. The seminary, in every case, will authorize the men for the ministry. They present them to the church, which means they present them to the council of presidents. They also slot them in the calls that come in, not because they're supposed to, but because they know the men better and are far more qualified to do so than district presidents who don't have the vaguest idea about who any of you are. So the district presidents have always encouraged the seminaries to slot them in, and we'll be doing that this spring too, of course. Then the presidents actually place the men. That's according to the Constitution of the Senate. Well, we meet down at the Chase Plaza Hotel, I guess it is, in St. Louis, that place there. And here comes Seminex, and they had all their men slotted. And Larry Wunderlich and I, we'd had all our men slotted, and Hank Eggold and company had all you people slotted. These are the guys that went out 2 years ago. And obviously, even when in the good old days, when you had only two seminaries, there would be conflict. And Eggold would fight for you guys. And the guys down there would fight for their guys. I must say, this guy Eggold, you can be proud of him. Boy, there's nothing that makes him so mad as when somebody, and I don't care if he's a conservative or liberal or anything else, tries to get a call away from one of you people when he's got you slotted there. He is a fighter. Up until this time, Springfield had a kind of a low profile. And in fact, I was getting a little distracted. I thought they should be a little tougher, defend their men a little more. But Hank came through, let me tell you. And of course, in true style, Costello delivered himself of a couple of real tirades. You can imagine what he said, for those of you who remember it. However, both the placement and vicarage thing were delayed, as you may remember. And this was real tough when, you know, fathers and grandfathers and mothers come and find that there's a service planned here and then the guys aren't placed. The council of presidents wouldn't do it. A number of the presidents would not. I accused them of blackmail. I'm not too well liked by certain district presidents for this reason, I guess, but I think I use the word blackmail and ransom. Yeah. The Springfielders in particular, I said, are just held up for ransom while you get these Seminex guys in. And I said, no way. We're going to fight them. And if you want to place these Seminex people, you go right ahead and place them. But you're not going to place them in those places where Springfield and St. Louis have slaughtered these men, because you don't have the constitutional right even to place them at all until they've been qualified by one of our two seminaries. Well, they finally, it took 7 days. No, 9 days. 9 days. And we finally won out. The Council of Presidents backed down. They would not disobey the Constitution. And so that's how, 2 years ago, the men here got the places that Egg Old arranged for them, and how we got the same for our St. Louis men. But the Seminex kept on, and they've been trying to get their men placed ever since. And of course, as you know, haven't been willing to obey the Constitution, but have still insisted that they get placed, and so they're in this rather difficult position. Then comes Anaheim, and of course we don't need to go into that. You recall that Seminex was pretty well regarded by the Anaheim Convention as another seminary, like Gettysburg Seminary or something like that. And the Elam movement, which had grown up in the meantime and had financed Seminex, was also pretty well chided for being a divisive movement. And the district presidents, those who had disobeyed the Constitution and ordained these people, who had not been authorized by a seminary or the synod, they too were, you know what's happening there, I don't have to rehearse that for you. So that in every way, Seminex has had a tough time of it. They have tried not the persuasive approach. Notice that they have refused now even to talk with Roland Wiederhinters in that committee of five. They have always approached it the way they always did, in a completely predictable way, head on with demand. And not once has this succeeded. But it seems to be the only modus operandi that these people feel is the right one for them. And so it goes on and on this way, and now we're at the impasse that we're at. Well, I don't think this is the story. There's a million things I haven't said. I hope I haven't sounded too prejudiced. I know a lot of Seminex students. The seniors are the boys that I had. And so are the vicars. And I like them. Some of them are quite conservative. Some of them are horrendously bad. They all are there. I wish we could get them into the ministry, a lot of them. I wish they'd transfer here tomorrow. I think we could probably make good theologians and pastors out of them. I know the men at Seminex. There's no unanimity there. Some of the men are as conservative as we are here. Others, I think, are completely relativistic in terms of their attitude toward doctrine. This will come out in time. You'll find out. It's not just the ordination of women and a few overt actions. It'll get more and more and more definite, clear as time goes on. And unfortunately, the Art Vincents and the other fine, run-of-the-mill Missouri Senate guys are being drawn along with the leaders, who are basically exegetes, a couple of systematicians. And it'll get stronger and firmer and further away from the Missouri Synod historic position as time goes on. Well, I talked probably more than I should have, and I would just, I don't know when we should quit, goodness. I talked for an hour and a quarter. But I would certainly like to have you ask some questions, but I don't want to keep the rest of you. Before questions, however, could we arrange whether you want another meeting? It will be on a totally different subject, something that maybe isn't contentious or polemical, but the day I have listed here, it's March 15th. I have to be gone next week. The following week I'm in the hospital, but April 5th I set Now, if that's all right with you, we'll set it for April 5th, and would you like to suggest now, in 30 minutes, and decide it, what you'd like to discuss? And maybe you'd rather discuss things rather than have me get up and palaver for an hour and a quarter. Do you have some suggestions? I think we talked about a few things, but I'm not sure what. Quickly, what was it?
Well, one of the thoughts, I don't know how to put together, many of us will be, some will be going out, you know, on big trips around in the fourth year, and the others of us will be going to Fort Wayne, but I think we're all going to be going into the same situation, which historically is different than what has happened previously.
Yeah.
Because of the fuel line and that, you know. I think some of us, at least I know myself, we might get some idea on what to expect or maybe how to handle them. So maybe there's a difference for different groups.
Yeah, this I had talked about as one of the items. Now, if you have no objection, any of you, maybe I could talk about this next time, and then you'll think about other topics. They could be eminently and totally theological. You can talk about confessional subscription or something like that. Or you could talk about justification by faith. I don't care. It's what you want. But why don't we decide that I'll talk on that rather practical thing next time, which will have many facets to it and hopefully will be helpful. And then you can think next time about the time after, okay? All right, if there's no objections, then let's do it that way, and I'll announce it in the soup scoop. Now, questions, comments, debate, argument, yes, sir?
One thing that always bothered me is, can you explain why the DAC in St. Louis, or whoever the group was that relieved Dr. Teachings of Sunni, why they picked such a delicate time during the academic year? Why didn't they wait till the school season was over and then let it go, where there would have been such a rumble and possibly things would have been a little bit more gentle?
Yes, it was the Board of Control, not the Board for Education. The Board of Control had been given the job to deal with him according to 3-12A, and this is what they try to do. Actually, they did suspend him that summer before school started. However, the matter was brought before the CCM, the Commission on Constitutional Matters of Missouri Synod. The CCM, rightly or wrongly, said, what you did is not unconstitutional, but it was very hasty and precipitous, like a judge and jury handling a case too quick or something. And there would always be a kind of a doubt or stigma because of the rapidity with which you did this thing. Therefore, we don't command you, but we strongly urge you to do it over and get all your evidence lined up, and so that there can be no question about the rectitude and constitutionality and morality of what you're doing. So the board obviously acquiesced. You're not going to fight with the board for unconstitutional matters. They were going to do it at a more propitious time. I don't know, of course, when you think of the church year liturgically, you can always get into trouble. Pentecost, Trinity, it's always wrong time. But they were going to do it right in the board meeting right before Christmas vacation. I think about the 19th of, or 18th or 17th of December. What happened? Dr. Peepcorn suddenly died. Dr. Peepcorn had been a pretty well-known fellow, personally well-liked by everybody, even those who didn't agree with him. And the board simply felt that to do this, I forget whether it was a day after or a day before the funeral, would be a tremendously unfeeling, callous type of thing. It would be construed that way. So they delayed another month and did it at their January meeting. I don't think the board had any idea that the reaction would be exactly what it was. And they certainly didn't suspect that the reaction was completely planned in advance. I talked with the lawyer of the synod some time ago, back there that spring, and he told me that he had every reason to believe that the Seminex concept was in the hopper immediately after Jack got elected president of the synod. back in 69 and 70. There had already been discussions with St. Louis U, Sullivan, that good Irishman who ran the outfit, and so forth. This is now known. So what the board didn't realize was that they weren't totally calling the shot. The majority men knew exactly what they were going to do, and the students, through student leadership, knew what they were going to do. And so what in hindsight looks to be an unfortunate thing, and is, because it happened at a time when the students were there, not when they were on vacation. If they had been on vacation, summer or winter vacation, there's no way that you could have easily gotten them to come to all these rallies and get all riled up and stirred up. And this happened with many of the very conservative students. It's not just an ideological thing. People got caught on this thing, see? Some of the men that stayed with 801 were somewhat liberal, ironically. It didn't go according to doctrinal positions particularly, although roughly it did. But they just, in hindsight, you can see these things. At the time, they never knew exactly what the reaction would be. I tend to answer questions too lengthily. What's another one? Yes, sir.
How is it that the change took place? What is your theory as to what happened to guys like Cameron and Rob Rochow, who earlier were conservative by anybody's evaluation, and then all of a sudden they all seem to change at the same time to become of a more liberal then?
No, I don't think they all changed at the same time. This is a gradual change. Von Rohrsauer changed at a certain point. He was the most adamant and outspoken enemy of the historical critical method on the faculty when I came there. When Dr. Charlemagne started a controversy, I guess I can put it that way, on the inerrancy of Scripture, no one fought him more adamantly than Dr. Von Rohrsauer. Together with Dr. Franzmann, Dr. Herb Bowman, who went with Seminex, and a few others. They changed. Sauer changed at a time before Herb Bowman did. Herb Bowman got caught up, I think, more. Sauer deliberately changed ideology by conviction, and long before anybody put all this kind of political or ecclesiastical pressure on him. In the case of Kemmer, I would have to say that he always was what he is. That's my opinion of Kemmerer. I don't think he changed his position. I think he always had the position he has now. But some of them did change, and very honestly have said so. This is the case with Sauer, Herb Bowman to a lesser extent, and others. Others, like Dr. C.S. Meyer, who also died before he was forced to take a stand too much, did, however, side with the majority, and I think on sympathy grounds. He's a good friend of mine, C.S. Meyer, and lived right across the street, and we're old buddies from way back. I think he just felt that they, like a lot of others, that they got a bad deal. Now, I happen to disagree with him, but I don't think he went over there because he was liberal. And this is the case with men like I mentioned Vincent, a very good friend of mine, and I could mention many others, who, as far as I know, never taught publicly or any type of false doctrine, but they did get into that orbit, and once they're there, they're there. There's a hand over here someplace. Yes?
Several of us went down the day after the students walked out, and I had the feeling that there was a total loss of what to do next. And yes, you've mentioned a few times that this was all prearranged, and I heard that too. Could you say a little more about...
Yeah, I think... you'll find, I don't want to give too many names because, although I don't mind mentioning my former colleagues, I don't like to mention students because I don't want to jeopardize them in any way. But there were students that were every day, and I could give you their names, and some of them are now there at that SEM, somewhere elsewhere, who were taking instructions every day from John Dahm and John Teach. They were in their office, and everyone knew what they were doing. And they would come out with a message for the rest of the students. So you had, I guess you'd call them student honchos. You got to remember that they had 12, no less, this is a very interesting thing. Teaching when he was there was, in the 5 years that he was there, I guess it was five, was only able to get one new faculty member on the faculty, Ed Schrader. This was over the loud protest of the President of the Synod. All the other people, like he wanted to get Dick Jungkund, who once taught here. He wanted to get Patty Wolbrecht. He wanted to get all kinds of people on that campus. He wasn't able to because the electors wouldn't allow it. What did he do? He hired staff people. And he had, at the end, no less than 12 staff people. How many do we have? We have Campbell, who isn't even theologically trained, so he doesn't even count. We had Lochner. We had Tesh. Two. To do non-theological, primarily non-theological jobs around the place. Two. They had 12. These staff people were all young men. Hardly any older than you are right now. None of them had been out in the ministry. They were recent graduates, picked, hand-picked by a teaching, Dom and company. These men took over the registrar's office. Probably the third most powerful office in the entire Iago helped Dom in the Turk report. That's academic dean. Undoubtedly the second most influential place in the whole sense. Yet those men had never even been called to the seminary as props. And those were the men who were in the dining hall like Wimpy and Veltz talking to the students. And the old grandpas like me, we haven't got time. We've got to be home with our wives. You get 12 of those guys, and the students remain pretty well in line, particularly the unmarried ones who are on campus all the time. So you had pretty good student leadership, staff leadership, and discipline. And you had these 106 motley, indiscriminate people. I remember I told them one day, I said, the only thing I can say about you guys that's stuck here is that you're loners. You just don't follow the crowd. That's about the only thing they had in common, because in other words, they were just all different from each other. Well, I've answered more than your question, but that's the best answer I can give. Another, yes. What has been the... Well, the board, what has happened is that the board did guarantee, for what it was worth, while they were on moratorium, that they would get at it as soon as possible. When they walked off, the board still meant to do so, but the faculty then walked off. Now, since that time, the faculty has refused to meet one-on-one, or one with the board, in any way to allow the board to examine the faculty on the basis of 309 New Orleans and the report of the president. In other words, to verify or falsify these reports. And to this very day, the faculty will not allow this to happen. They will meet as a faculty with anybody. But no man will come in hat in hand to that board and recognize the authority of that board to examine him. And so the board hasn't been able, from that day on, to carry out what they promised the students they would try to do. Anything else? Yes?
A couple weeks ago, I was very interested. We had an opportunity to attend the seminary in the University, right after this. Since that time, he was initiating a new hope for the seminary in place of the North Carolina. Do you think that over the coming months, the workplace and next year, and this will affect our place compared to going to districts like we have a preference in those six areas? Under control of one of the eight presidents,
you think we'll find a position? I'd say this, and we can talk about this next night. This is a lot of guesswork, and I'm no authority on it. I would say that in the case, let's say, of Restmeyer or Hecht, there will be no calls forthcoming whatsoever. If there are any vacancies, and there aren't too many in those districts, they've already filled them up with Seminex people, they will be filled with Seminex people, in total defiance to the Synod, and they couldn't care less. Now, New Neighbor can't afford to do that. They may have said, we love you, Herman, and we want to keep you, but they all said, Herman, we want you to obey the Constitution. 94 to 50 or something like that. And it doesn't matter if Herman wants to disobey, he won't be able to. And there will probably be this spring, I would estimate, at least 5 or more calls in southern Illinois available. I know this. They've already called me, some of the members. I know those people. I preach at their churches. They will want a candidate. And I would hope, I would really hope, that not one of you people would hesitate to take a call there if it were given you. It's a good district. They are fine people down there, and they need good, solid pastors, and they are going to call candidates because they want men like you to go there. And I'd hope you'd go. So I don't look for too much difficulty in this sense. The real tough fellows are not going to allow you to be called in their district. The people who would like to break the Constitution, like New Neighbor or some of the others, will allow you to be called, and I would hope you'd go, because you might help a congregation that needs you. Yes?
What are the implications